When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Hey out there, rock and rollers around the world. Welcome to the 25th episode of the Ugly American Werewolf in London Rock Podcast, recorded right here in central London, right off Abbey Road. And 25th is a nice little milestone for us here on The Wolf. A lot of podcasts don't last that long, from what I understand. When we first got started, a couple of people snickered at us and said, hey, you know, let me know when you get to your 10th episode, because a lot of people don't make it past the 5th or 6th. They just run out of topics, they run out of ideas, or they're convinced that the first few shows are going to make them worldwide rich and famous. And that's not really what Jackson and I are into this for. We're just two old friends who love rock music, who love to talk about it, love to talk about the minutiae of who writes the songs, who plays on the songs, when and where are they recorded, what's the entirety of the album, what are the B-sides, what other bonus tracks or unreleased material were recorded around the same time, how do these guys fit into the rock and roll family tree. And that's something we've been doing for decades, and we're glad to still be able to do it. Now all we do is record it and share it with folks around the world. And we've got people in more than 50 countries listening to us now, and that really blows us away. So it's not just our friends and family who are making fun of us. We've got people all over the world. Now, you know, there are a lot of great rock fans out there who want to share their knowledge and want to know more about the bands they love. And so that's really all we're doing here. So for our 25th show in just 6 months, we're going to talk about a band that, if you've listened to our previous shows, you probably guessed we were going to get to at some point. And that's the 80s first real supergroup, Asia, made up of Carl Palmer from Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Steve Howe of Yes, Jeff Downs of The Buggles, and also a brief stint in Yes, and John Wetton on the bass and lead vocals, who had been in King Crimson, Uriah Heep, Roxy Music, Band Called UK, had a distinct, powerful, yet soulful voice. So all these guys are big progressive rock stars, but could they make pop rock music? So in the early 80s, that's exactly what they did. They got together and formed Asia, the 80s first supergroup. And thanks to MTV and Geffen Records, they took off. Their single, Heat of the Moment, was huge for MTV. And of course, Jeff Downs, having been in the Buggles, was a part of two seminal moments in MTV history. First of all, the first video they ever played, Video Killed the Radio Star, starred him and his partner Trevor Horn in the Buggles, who eventually went on to be in Yes for a small stint. Then, at the end of 1983, Asia played in the first concert ever televised live via satellite across the United States of America, Asia in Asia. So Jeff Downs might not be very well known to the average music fan, but he was incredibly important in the creation and development of MTV as a huge part of pop culture, especially in American life. Now, we came to Asia a little bit late in life. We found them when we were in college, not necessarily when they first came out in the early 80s. And they just have a certain sound that hit me in a certain spot that I really liked. So over the years, I've researched them. I've gotten to know all their records, listened to all of them through. And look, the original band only lasted really 2 years, not even. And a couple of records, a couple of tours, and that was it. And they had to split up, go their separate ways. And it was never quite the same again. Now, they did get together in 2006 to kind of celebrate their 25th anniversary and to do a tour. And from there, they stuck together for a little while, did more records and more tours. And we'll get into that. But this episode, we're going to focus solely on the formation of Asia, their sound, and their first album, Asia, which sold more than 4 million copies in the United States alone. Heat of the Moment was number one on the rock charts for 2 months, and the album went on to be the number one selling album in America in 1982. Huge. Unfortunately, due to all sorts of different circumstances, their success didn't last. But the songs from the first album created a fan base, of which Jackson and I are a part, that have remained loyal over the years and allowed them to continue to put out records, to continue to tour, to get the original band back together, and to still have an effect on pop culture. Now, as usual, you can listen to all of our past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com. And you can download us and subscribe anywhere, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, anywhere you get your podcast. Be sure to follow us at ugly_werewolf and at ActionJack72 on Twitter. But for now, we want to tell you about one of our favorite bands, a band that is much maligned, a band that is overlooked and forgotten by most folks. But this band means a lot to us. Heat of the Moment was an amazing pop song. I think it's the best pop rock song of all time, bar none. And the first Asia album is the best pop prog rock album ever made. And I wish I could play it for you here. We don't have the rights, but you can go out and check it out. And I encourage you to do so. So listen to us going in depth on Asia's 1982 debut album, Here on the Wolf.
Pantheon podcast listeners, Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
So, what kind of reaction do you get from people when you talk about Asia? Or do you just never speak in polite conversation about Asia?
Who are we talking about? Are we talking about like people our age, people younger, my wife?
What? friends, you know, maybe if you're talking about music or, you know, maybe you hear a song or something like that. When Asia comes up, like, what's the tone?
I think the tone is kind of like, my son likes to use the term, okay, boomer.
Okay, boomer?
Yeah. Like, you know, like you're a baby boomer and you're old as anything. So that's kind of what it feels like to me. Like what age? Like from the 80s? I've heard of that before. Mm-hmm. Why are you bringing this up right now? I'm like, oh, they're great. Are they? Because I only ever heard one song maybe a million years ago.
Right. That's kind of the thing, right? Like maybe they remember Heat of the Moment. Maybe they remember Don't Cry. That's about it, right? They were kind of
correct
one hit wonders and kind of victims of the MTV generation, right? And although, I mean, you know, it's funny because we kind of got into them a little bit in college, but that's just because we finally found a song. Look, I didn't really know Asia that well in the early 80s. Because in 1982, when their album came out, when it came out, I was 8. And later that summer, I turned 9. And I was just starting to get into music, right? And I'm just starting to see these guys, Duran Duran and Men at Work and people like that on MTV. Two songs from the first album, Heat of the Moment and Only Time Will Tell, first 2 singles. They were in the air, right? They were on the radio in 1982. They were on MTV, though I didn't get to watch it all that much. But I, you know, back in the day on the radio, they wouldn't always say, that was Heat of the Moment by Asia, and now here comes That's All by Genesis. You know, it was, they would play four or five songs, and maybe you'd be lucky if you heard what one of the bands was, right? They wouldn't always name the songs and the artists. So I didn't ever really know Heat of the Moment or Asia, but I obviously the melody of the song got into my brain and wormed its way in there. And then once I heard it again when I was older, I'm like, oh, wait, that's that song that I liked from when I was a kid. What is it? And it was Asia. So Heat of the Moment, I always had this like infatuation with the song, but I never really knew who it was by. And then once we were older in college, I'm like, oh man, I love that song, Heat of the Moment. Well, do they have like a greatest hits album or something I can pick up so I can get that and see what other good songs on it? So that's when we got the greatest hits album that we had that came out in 1990, which is called Asia Then and Now.
Then
right?
and Now, yeah. Correct.
Which had
correct.
Five songs from back in the day, from the first couple albums, and then five songs that John Wetton and Jeff Downs had kind of gotten together and made later in the decade. And I think maybe Carl Palmer was around too. So it's then now five old songs and five new songs, which is kind of weak if you think about it. It's like you don't even have enough for a greatest hits, like pure 9 or 10 song greatest hits. And you also don't have enough to be like, okay, we're back and here's some new stuff. You don't have that either. You know, it's kind of the worst of both worlds.
It definitely felt a little – well, I remember when that record came out and it was Days Like These was the single, the new single. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking the same thing, like that's a little janky because it's not either one of those things. It's not a new record and it's not – yeah, like you have, it's your greatest hits. There's five tracks on here that are greatest hits. But back to the beginning, I really think that – I remember the video from Heat of the Moment and mm-hmm. I remember we had just gotten cable and my parents had these friends – that had like kids that were older than I was. So maybe they were like in high school and MTV was verboten back then. That was Satan was speaking directly to you through MTV. You're not watching that.
Right.
So I was like, Hey guys, you know, what are you guys doing in here? You know, what's on TV? And Heat of the Moment was on with the images that kept scrolling across and changing. And I'm
That's
like,
right.
Oh, this is really cool. And that riff at the beginning, there was something about that. That's still one of the coolest rock riffs ever laid down. And it's like, I think that kind of just started me into the like, that is just really cool. It's really intense. I mean, can you imagine standing on stage and hitting those chords and having people flip out? Like, that's so awesome. And yeah, I didn't know anything about, you know, I remember there was press for it. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, it's all these bands coming together. I'm like, well, I never heard any of those bands. So I guess they were cool a million years ago. But I mean, yes. Okay, cool. Yeah. Like that was before 90125 came out. So I had never, okay, like.
That's,
you know,
right.
One of those, oh, yes, yeah, King Crimson, yeah, cool, yeah, I've heard of those guys before. No, I haven't.
Emerson, Lake & Palmer, like, what is that, a law firm? I've never heard of them.
Yeah.
Right? To set the stage a little bit, so it's kind of the first super group of the 80s, right? Guys who had success in previous bands who kind of found each other. And from what I found, progressive rock bands, and the big ones being like Pink Floyd and Yes, Genesis, King Crimson, and there's others, obviously Emerson, Lake, and Palmer in there. I would throw Rush in there, although they're a little hard for those guys sometimes. Uriah Heep, you could probably throw in there. All these guys kind of know each other, and they kind of switch into each other's bands and things like that. Like, for instance, Greg Lake is on the original Court of the Crimson King by King Crimson. Eventually, he left, and in 1972, he was replaced by John Wetton on bass and lead vocals, you know. And Bill Bruford had been in Yes, and then he went into King Crimson. He had a cup of coffee in Genesis when Phil was first put out front to sing. He was in a band called UK at the end of the 70s with John Wetton and a couple of other guys. It didn't really get big in America, but, you know, it's good progressive stuff. So, and John Wetton played in Roxy Music with Phil Manzanera. He played in Uriah Heep for a while, you know. So he was kind of a guy who was never – he was in a band called Family. So he was never a kind of huge star in his own right. He was always kind of filling in for somebody else. And then his band UK did all right, but it wasn't huge. So then by 1980-81, after he'd made a solo album, he was looking to do something cool. Steve Howe, of course, was really the only guitarist of consequence in the history of Yes, on all the classics, really, except for, of course, 90125, where Trevor Rabin came in. But he figures into the Asia story as well. And so after Drama, the record and tour with Yes, which featured Trevor Horn and Jeff Downs from the Buggles, replacing Rick Wakeman and John Anderson, that fell apart. I think it was physically difficult on Trevor to try to sing like John Anderson, and I don't know if they were really accepted by the true Yes fans. So Yes kind of went away and took a break, and that left them. And then ELP, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, had been on a break too. So Carl Palmer, the drummer, who's a fantastic drummer, was available. And I think it was John Kolodner, A&R great. He was at Atlantic, but he went to Geffen to work with David Geffen to really pump up their rock catalog. And he got John Wetton together with Steve Howe so they could start writing some songs together. And that was kind of the genesis of Asia. Of course, eventually they were able to pull in Jeff Downes because Steve knew him from his time together in Yes. And actually, Trevor Rabin was thrown in there for a while, which a lot of people don't know. It's very interesting that the guy who replaced Steve Howe in Yes was actually going to, they tried playing together in Asia. And it just didn't work.
Yeah, and you know, you went back to this the supergroup deal. Mm-hmm. You were saying the first supergroup from the 80s. I think they were the first supergroup, period, that were marketed as such. I mean, you had other things like, I mean, you can say Crosby, Stills, and Nash, that was a supergroup.
Right.
Yeah, Blind Faith, that was obviously a supergroup. But this one, I remember they really pushed that idea of, you know, these are, all these bands are coming together and making this great record. And so I think they kind of had a lot of, maybe what started off as kind of like a pet project, like you were talking about, like, oh, you know, we're hanging around. Yeah, let's do some stuff together. Was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever released. Oh, hey, easy there. And then, yeah, they put the record out and it was huge. They had huge hits off of it. But I think then, you know, that starts to, oh boy, maybe this was, maybe we hyped this a little bit too much that we were all super pals and, you know, right. This is going to go on forever.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, they made the record and Kolodner, who we also talk about on our previous episode on Aerosmith, because he was huge for Aerosmith and reigniting their flame in the 80s and 90s. He's like, I don't hear a single. I don't know which one is going to really be the single. And so Wetton had a little bit of some lyrics and Jeff had a little bit of a tune. And the last song they wrote for the album was Heat of the Moment. And it's why you have the line, catch the pearl and ride the dragon's wings, because they already had the Roger Dean artwork of the big dragon splashing around in the ocean with this huge pearl up in the sky that I don't know if he's fighting or he's trying to eat it or whatever it is. It's an incredible Roger Dean cover, an amazing piece of art.
I was actually thinking, because I was thinking about this too, about Roger Dean and the tie-in with, you know, having it look like obviously old Yes records or classic Yes records. I think it's one of the coolest things he's ever done. And I think while there are other ones that you can look at and say, wait, which one was that again? Oh, yeah, that was this album. You know the Asia one right off the bat. There's only one thing going on. It's just the dragon coming out of the water. That was a really cool, nice touch. And it's crazy, too, when you say that about that single, mm-hmm. how many times you've heard that same story. Like, oh, you know, we didn't know, and then we needed one more song, and we sat down and wrote Blump, and right. That was the big one. Like, what? What were you waiting for on that? But sometimes that's just creative spark.
I think Carrie, who wrote Dust in the Wind, it was like that. You know, it's like, all right, we kind of need one more song. It's like, well, I got this one thing my wife said I should make out of the practice, you know, figure that I used to do on my guitar. I guess we could make a song out of that. It's Dust in the Wind, man, you know?
Yeah, yeah. What were you waiting for?
And it just leads you to believe, you know, how much is still out there in the air? How much was never recorded? You know, how much they said, yeah, I don't really like that. I'm not going to work on that. And it could have been amazing. You never know. Or how many people out there who maybe said, hey, Dad, I want to learn to play the piano. And your dad said, I'm not buying you a piano. It's expensive. It's going to take up a bunch of room in the living room. And then after 6 months, you're not going to want to do it anymore.
Well, look at the Ozzy Osbourne story. I mean, he said when he left Black Sabbath, he was like, and Randy Rhoads sat down and taught him like a musical teacher how to write songs. Okay, here's what you do first. And if he hadn't done that, who knows? Right. So, yeah, I mean, how many people were like that maybe have talent, but were never encouraged? Or on the flip side, how many of these guys that can write songs didn't write it because they were like, you know what? I think there's cocaine and booze in the other room. Let's do that instead. Yay.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. It's crazy to me how you can look at it from two ways. You can see things that took forever to write. Like, oh man, I was working on that song for a year. And then stuff like, you know, I slipped and fell in the shower and boom, here comes something incredible.
It's like a spirit enters the room and you just have to let it, you know, and you have to let it engulf you and be a part of you and let it come through you. You get that stuff out of there. It's a moment of time. So many great songs are written in, you know, 5 or 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. So,
and I can imagine too, if you're a musician and you're musician A, and you're kind of just like, eh, and then the other person comes in and says, like dust in the wind, here, I've got this, and they start, and then that just, the light comes on. I know exactly what we're doing with that. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
And so Kolodner apparently didn't really like the Dragon album cover at first. He's like, well, it's a little bit too much like Yes. Plus the Asia logo, the name Asia, he did in a kind of certain font, in a Roger Dean kind of font with like the pyramid on the A's. And it gave it a brand. He didn't necessarily like that at all. But although he's made some amazing decisions and gotten some great stuff released over the years, I think he's earned his way into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a contributor. He was wrong about that, man. The iconic logo and that album cover is classic.
Yeah, and I think that if you go back and look at it, all the giant rock bands, the Rolling Stones, you know, Metallica, they all have a, like, you can just look at the font and know what it is. And you're right, that Egyptian-looking Pyramid mm-hmm. Asia font, you can't miss it. They use it on all the records. Yeah, you need to have a brand on there.
Led Zeppelin, Iron Maiden. Mm-hmm. You know what it looks like, right? You know their font.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. And then all of a sudden, Geffen knew they had something special on their hands. So they got Godley and Cream to come and shoot, direct their videos to get on this new thing, MTV, which had just come out in 1981, right? So MTV had only been out maybe 7 or 8 months, 9 months or something, when the first Asia record came out. And you're right, yeah, with the screens going back and forth and that huge riff of Steve Howe to begin, it's heavy and yet it's completely pop. And all these guys come from this progressive background, right? Where it's like, you're talking about long solos, very intricate, long songs, you know, sometimes the whole side of an album, time change signatures and all this crazy stuff. And they're like, let's make this more of an AOR kind of thing. Let's take all that great stuff, but squish it down to 4 or 5 minutes instead of like 12 or 15 minutes. And the critics railed against it. And I can understand why they would at first. You know, critics have to criticize stuff. It sounds very Journey, REO, Speedwagon-y, polished kind of.
Yeah, manufactured. Yeah, like,
right.
Like, yeah, write me a song to be on the radio. Okay, here we go.
Okay, here it is.
And to your point with Steve Howe, like, yeah, go back and listen to those early, well, every Yes record he was ever on, that doesn't sound like anything he's ever done before. Like, if you were to hear that, who was that? Steve Howe from Yes? No, that's not him. He plays intricate, like you said, classical pieces. And this is like your AC/DC, you know, chord, just, you know, mm-hmm. windmilling it up there on stage. So, yeah, I could see how people would have said this is just manufactured junk for the radio.
Yeah, but it wasn't. You know, these are amazing musicians. They got together on their own. It came together naturally. They worked hard on the songs. And now they had a big corporate machine. David Geffen gets stuff done in the record industry, now in the movie industry. He gets stuff done. And John Kolodner, the A&R genius, did as well. You know, and they got him onto MTV. And they got it out there. And it sold incredibly well. It was the number one selling album in the United States of America in 1982. I'll say that again. It was the number one selling album in the United States of America in 1982. Thriller was number one in 83 and 84. Like, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA was 85. Whitney Houston was 1986. You know, The Wall was 1980. That's who you have to be to sell the most albums in a year. And in 1982, it was Asia.
And I think that's one of those, that's the biggest thing when people are like, yeah, you know, I gotta remember them from back. And then you tell them that, like, that can't possibly be, because you're right. You think of all those, you know, like Thriller sold, what, like 60 million copies or something?
Nuts.
Yeah, it should not, there's no way that should be a true statement, but it is.
It absolutely is.
And that just, it proves that those songs were extremely rock friendly, radio friendly, MTV friendly, and people went out and just bought the thing. And I think it was probably because of the cover too. It all came together in a package you wanted to have.
Yeah, that's right. You know, and John Wetton was a good looking guy. He kind of had some really serious battles with alcohol, which led him to gain weight. But at the beginning and kind of heyday of Asia, he was still in pretty good shape. It was, you know, was tan, you know, he looked good in the videos, you know. And so it was working for them, you know. And I guess it hit my brain at a very formative time. And for whatever reason, that sound, and it's not a real long song. It's not even 4 minutes long. It's the shortest song on the record. Yeah, it's and I think the single version might even be a little shorter, but the version on the record is not 4 minutes long. I don't know. It just hits me in a certain spot where I'm like, That's pop rock genius right there. Now, if you were 20 and that song came out, you're probably like, that's nothing compared to, you know, the stuff I was listening to in the 70s, you know, or whatever. I understand that. I honestly can't explain why I love it so much. It just hits me in a certain spot in my brain that I love. I can't explain it.
Well, if you would just want to talk about that track in particular for a second, like it kind of has a lot of stuff going for it. Obviously the chords at the beginning, mm-hmm. and then the drums come in, and then Wetton comes in, kind of not by himself, but like definitely featured with the vocals. He's got a really strong rock voice. Like, you know, maybe you hadn't heard King Crimson, but you're like, yeah, this guy can really belt it out. And then the solo's pretty good. The chorus, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's another one of those songs too, where like there's some songs you're like, is this A or which one that you know heat of the moment right off the bat. As soon as that chord comes in, you know to just crank that thing up as loud as it'll go.
That's right. And yeah, and John Wetton had an amazing voice. It was beautiful. It was powerful because he could do ballads as well as he could do a big rock song. You know, when he died, obviously a lot of people paid tribute to him, but Clapton released like a little instrumental in his honor. I'm like, you know, Clapton's one of the guys who didn't really ever record with him as much as they both recorded with so many people. But he came out and was like, that voice was extraordinary. You know, I'm so sorry to see him go. I'm like, well, that was pretty cool of Eric. But that was huge. It got to number 4 on the top 40, and it got to number 1 on mainstream rock. And I think it was number 1 for like 8 or 9 weeks, the song. And that's probably why I have such a good memory of it, even though I maybe necessarily didn't know it was them, because it was just on so much and it got into my brain, you know.
And then if you switch to the next big single, Only Time Will Tell, then that's, you kind of do the same thing, but it's now it's Downs on the keyboard with mm-hmm. that intro that you know exactly what that song is too. So it's kind of the same formula in air quotes, that it's got that signature intro to it, but not the guitar. So I always thought that was kind of cool too, that they could switch it up and not just have the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, I'll have to agree with you there. Yeah, absolutely. But even like the break in Heat of the Moment, you know, they kind of go to a break and Carl's kind of on his cymbals there going along, and then Jeff puts in a little keyboard and John thumps his bass, and then Steve comes down on his neck a couple of times, you know, and then it builds back up. Carl Palmer's an amazing drummer. I saw Carl Palmer play with Asia actually when they're opening for Journey a few years back. And I'm like, you know, everyone's kind of older. Maybe everyone's lost a step. Not Palmer, man. He is still an on top of it, amazing drummer, still in great shape. And he kicked it out. I was impressed. I walked away that night just thinking one thing, Carl Palmer still got the goods.
And that's interesting too, because you figure the drumming and drumming at a high level is a young guy's game. To be that into it at that age, I mean, I don't know how old he was when you saw him, but that's a testament to really putting the work in and not just like, I play every once in a while. Nah, you've really got to keep it together to do it at that level.
I felt bad for Carl Palmer around that time too, because you know, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer have gotten back together over the years and done more tours and some music and stuff like that. But within a pretty short period of time, Greg Lake died, Keith Emerson committed suicide, and John Wetton died. So it was like 2/3 of his bandmates in his biggest band were lost. He's like, well, I can't do ELP anymore, but at least I can still do Asia because they're back. And then John Wetton died. It's like, oh, geez, you know, because that was supposed to be a big comeback for them, was fronting Journey, being the opening act for Journey. Journey was back in a huge way doing arenas and big amphitheaters. So for them to come out and do 50 minutes, you know, 8 or 9 songs, their best hits, that's a big deal for them. They're not doing clubs and theaters. They're in front of big audiences where they should be. It'd be a nice way to kind of go out in style. And they did, but it wasn't quite what it could have been because John wasn't there, which is kind of a recurring theme throughout the history of Asia.
Yeah, I was going to say that. And unfortunately, when you replace the vocalist and the vocalist is distinctive like that, and you want to do the same thing, it's never the same deal. Like, to me, you've got to go the Van Halen, Sammy Hagar, where it's like, we're doing something different now. Right. You're not trying to be the same guy. And I think that was always kind of the deal with Asia. Like, they had that Asia in Asia with Greg Lake.
Right.
And I was watching that. And first of all, let me point out that if you watch the whole thing, what's his name comes out and does the intro, Mark Goodman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine, this is a little bit of a tangent here, but I can't imagine anything cooler than being one of those original MTV VJs. I mean, the stories they must be able to tell are insane because they got to do all that stuff. All of it.
I know. I saw this week, as we were recording this, this week Martha Quinn turned 62. I said, Martha Quinn is 62? How old am I? Holy mackerel. I know. She still looks pretty good, but you know, when she was on MTV, she was just the coolest, cutest thing in the whole world.
And the other cool thing too was that back then, since there were only four of them, you had to do everything. Like they were talking to Boy George, and then in 10 minutes, I'm going to be talking to Ozzy Osbourne.
Right.
Because there wasn't like the rock person and this person, that was it. But back to the Asia. So then Greg Lake comes out, right? It's not, and then I think it was one of those like, did we know that Wetton wasn't here? And then Lake, I mean, Lake sounds great and he plays the bass great, but he's trying to do a Wetton impression. Yeah. I think that's the deal. And it's like, hey, wait a minute. What is this?
Yeah, I'll talk more about that later. I have plenty to say on that subject, but I want to focus on the first album here because honestly, it's one of those albums I can listen to over and over and over and over, and it never gets old. And for what it was billed as, it's just like, oh, this like corporate polished BS AOR thing that was just designed to sell a lot of records. It's amazing music. To put the progressive stuff in a condensed way, a little more rock, a little more popular, I think they did something that not many bands have ever really done. I think it's special. And it upsets me that more people don't know it or hold it in the dark.
Let me ask you this question, though, because this came out in what, 82?
Mm-hmm.
Did this influence 90125? Did Yes hear this and say, I think this is the formula we need to.
Well, perhaps, emulate. You know, because they had Trevor Rabin. He probably heard some of their demos, some of the songs they were working on. And then he goes to work with Squire and White. They were going to call it Cinema, you know. They're going to call it something other than Yes. But then they said, no, you know, we can get more mileage out of a Yes record than a Cinema record.
Correct.
You may be onto something there, Jackson.
You know, because the thing is, it's like you see these tracks, you're like 348, 444. Okay, obviously that's what people want to hear. I mean, this album is selling like it's nobody's business. This is what the blueprint we need to follow. I don't know. But to your point, this is kind of a cool deal too, because if you had only ever heard Heat of the Moment and Only Time Will Tell, maybe Soul Survivor, you know, you kind of get into the rest of this and you're like, no, hey, wait a minute. This is a pretty good record. Forget everything else. Forget the hype. Forget the two big singles. Yeah, you can really listen to this whole thing. And that's kind of a cool, I mean, we've talked about this before. It's really cool when you find that like treasure, like, hey, wait a minute. Here's some other cool tracks I've never heard before. Yeah. This is awesome.
And the sad thing is I never heard the whole album until the heyday of Napster. And all of a sudden that album that you never really got to listen to or that you had on cassette, but you never upgraded to CD. Now you can download it and you get it on CD or you get it on MP3 and take it with you or whatever. And I know that cost changed the record business and it cost bands some money. But honestly, to me, I went out and bought a lot more records because I downloaded stuff from Napster or wherever for free, then got to listen to it. And then like, oh, well, then I should buy their new album when it comes out, or I should buy the 25th anniversary of this or whatever. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, right? I mean, it gets your music out. It gets more people aware of it. But yeah, if they get it for free, they're probably a lot less likely to buy it.
Okay, so we had talked about Then and Now, right? The greatest hits record. And it had Heat of the Moment and it had Only Time Will Tell.
Yep.
Okay? And we listened to that one night. It was one fateful night. We listened to it a million times.
Yeah.
So you said you hadn't listened to that whole record until you downloaded it on Napster.
Right.
So my brother went to Indiana University and I drove him out there one year to get him set up. And then I was hanging around with Greg and John.
Okay.
So a couple of days and then I went back. I was hanging out with John and he said to me, hey, you love these guys, right? And he had the original Asia record that he had bought. Not the greatest hits, but the original.
The LP?
He was like, CD? Yeah. No, the CD.
Okay.
He was like, yeah, I'm tired of this. You want it? I'm like, I'll take it if you don't want it. That was the first time I ever had the full copy of that thing.
Wow.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you only listening to the two tracks, not liking it, and then just gifting it to me, because I'll take it.
That's amazing, dude. That's so funny. And did it have Ride Easy on it?
Did it have Ride Easy on it? I would have to go back and check. I haven't actually listened to that in a while. I don't think so. I think it was one of those ones. It was probably like an early 90s copy that was like the nice price, or mm-hmm. the, you know, one of those ones that you could buy for like $8, but it was like all it was blank on the inside. So no, I don't think it had Ride Easy on it.
Because that's the thing. As far as I know, this was my first – having bonus tracks on CDs and stuff like that became very prevalent in the late 80s and 90s. Like, buy it on CD, we're going to give you an extra track or two. And this came out in 1982. Yes, it came out on CD originally, but almost nobody had a CD player. But if you bought it on CD or cassette, even on cassette, they gave you a bonus track. The 10th song was Ride Easy, which was the B-side to Heat of the Moment in America and Around the World. I think Time Again – was the B-side in the UK. And if I can find that somewhere, Jackson, once record stores are open this week, I might just try to pick that up. But
oh, that would be cool.
That would be cool to have the UK version of it.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, Ride Easy was on the cassette back in the day. One more Heat of the Moment note, though. There's the famous line, now you find yourself in 82, the disco hotspots hold no charm for you. Everyone always assumes that you're talking about 1982, because that's when this comes out. But apparently, there was a disco hotspot here in London called 82, kind of like Studio 54 in New York. And of course, John Wetton, being a musician in some big bands, you know, he dated models and things like that and got to go to places like 82. And, you know, Heat of the Moment and even Time Will Tell, I feel like he's singing these to women, and they're not love songs. They're not sweet songs. They're kind of like, you know, you're going to miss me when I'm gone. You're going to screw things up in your life, and you're going to realize I was right about stuff.
Wait, what are you talking about? Like, when your looks are gone and you're alone?
Right. How many nights you sit beside the phone?
You'll be sorry.
Yeah. Used to look at magazines, girls, wishing they were you.
I never knew that about that, about 82. I just figured that was the year because that's when it came out. So that's interesting. And that makes it a little more timely than you know, like, oh, you know, 1982, good for you.
And then when we saw them at Celebrities Nightclub in Orlando, which is the only time we ever went there. Of course, the lineup was different then, but they had to play the song. Was it 92? Did they say, now you find yourself in 92?
I believe so. Like, you know, with the wink.
Right. Bing. Yeah, exactly.
Although that was everybody except for Wetton, I think.
I don't think Carl Palmer was in the band then. I think it was Jeff Downes, John Payne. They had a different drummer.
Okay.
Palmer had been back with him from 89 to 91 when they did like Live in Russia, and they did some of the stuff on Then and Now. But then he left to go back to ELP. Steve Howe came out as a featured guest because he had played on four or five songs on the 1992 album Aqua, which featured John Payne on lead vocals and bass. But they publicized the hell out of it. Like Asia featuring Steve Howe, or special guest Steve Howe. Like it was a big deal. And he came out after maybe four or five songs, and he did some of his acoustics stuff and obviously, you know, the old songs together, which is cool. But back to the original record. Yeah, those first two songs, Heat of the Moment, Only Time Will Tell, both had great videos. They both stand up the test of time. Yeah, it's got a lot of keyboard in it, but it's not just synth pop from the early 80s keyboard that's disposable. Jeff Downes is a hell of a composer. He's still making great music to this day. And those two are fantastic. And for a while, we liked Only Time Will Tell better than Heat of the Moment, kind of because I just think we knew Heat of the Moment well, and Only Time Will Tell is the one we didn't know as well. So it's like, oh yeah, we like this one, right?
Yeah, and the keyboard intro to that is really cool. And I think back to your original point here about what kind of gets lost in this whole thing, because it was such a giant record. These guys are all really good musicians. Like you were talking about Carl Palmer, I think he kind of dumbed it down for some of this stuff to fit in with the track. I mean, he could have been going nuts back there.
Absolutely.
But yeah, when it flashes like that, it's really cool. And I think it's too bad that this couldn't have lasted longer, because they could have done, I mean, who knows what they could have done.
I know. There's some great sound on here. I do think that they, especially on the chorus and stuff like that, where they may have Jeff Downes and Steve Howe singing some backup, but I think it's like there's one track for Jeff Downs. There's one track for Steve Howe, and there's four for John Wetton. You know, like they really kind of pump up. So it sounds like there's this chorus of people when really it's just John Wetton on four different tracks or something like that.
Yeah.
But it sounds great.
It's kind of, right. But it's impossible to harmonize with yourself. That's correct.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. All right. And then Soul Survivor, that was the third single. They did make another single and video, Soul Survivor. It came out later after the summer of 82. But again, it's kind of heavy. It's another Wetton Downs written track. And a lot of, again, big, fat choruses, perfect for AOR.
And a great chorus, too. Again, I think this was one of those, like, you know, you tracked it a couple times. But yeah, the chorus is cool. The vocals are great. I think that, unfortunately, at this point in time, after you had those two big ones, this one, I don't want to say fell flat, but it's just not as popular as the other two. It's not quite as radio-friendly, I think.
I have to agree with that. It's a great song and all, but I mean, yeah, compared to the other two, that's going to be tough treading anyway.
Yeah.
Now, after that is a song called One Step Closer, and I love this song, One Step Closer. It's a little softer now, you know, compared to the first three, but again, it has a great rhythm to it, and Jeff gets to do some strange stuff kind of on his keyboard at the beginning, kind of a sweet almost song, but then One Step Closer, nice big chorus, and Steve puts a little bit on there. Steve actually co-wrote this one with John Wetton, and you know, at any time we're taking, you just need to go one more step, I break out One Step Closer, right?
That's a good track, but again, it's, I don't know, I would have loved to have talked to people who had bought this originally. How many people actually, of the people that bought the record originally, how many people actually got this far into it? Because unfortunately, you've got Heat of the Moment, Only Time Will Tell, Soul Survivor as 1, 2, and 3, either on the record or on the tape. Did you keep going? I hope so, but I don't know. Yeah.
Now, I hope you got to the last track on the first side, because Time Again is a fantastic song. It's the only song written by all four of them. I think it was the first song they ever wrote together as a group. And it's a little heavier. Well, I don't know if heavy's the right word. It's a little more rocked out than progged out. Some great drum work on there by Carl.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, you kind of start to see him flex it out a little bit in this one. Yeah, I think I don't know. I mean, I don't know if he's played in the box that they were looking for at the beginning, mm-hmm. or on the big tracks. But yeah, it is cool to watch him, because that was one thing where I was watching a whole bunch of videos to do this show. And, you know, people kept commenting, you know, he's so great. He's underrated. And I think that really is true, because, you know, you hear the big ones. Okay, you know, Neil from Rush, mm-hmm. you know, John Bonham. But go back and listen to that. Like, he's really good at what he does,
yeah.
and does not get the acclaim, because I don't think that ELP was that big of a band in the United States. Again, you know, like all of these proggy bands, they just kind of like, oh yeah, they're cool, but you know, they don't get the accolades they deserve.
Right. You know, and ELP will probably never get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Asia certainly won't. So, you know, Carl Palmer is going to be, you know, a little underrated, but Steve Howe does some of that great Steve Howe work on Time Again. I just think it's awfully solid, you know, and then you get into side two. Look, the first five songs, all the songs on the first side were under 5 minutes. The second side, they're all over 5 minutes. So this is where they can stretch them out a little bit, maybe get a little bit more of that progginess that they're all famous for. And Wildest Dreams is, again, kind of a big, full-bodied punch in the face, you know?
Yeah, and I don't – this was not a single, but I think it probably could have been.
Mm-hmm.
If maybe not on MTV, but maybe more on rock radio, where you could get away with the 5 minute, you know, boundaries.
Right.
But yeah, no, this was a cool track. And it's one of those ones where if you just were listening to the hits, you probably didn't make it to side two of this thing.
Right. Which is too bad, because there's some great stuff on here. The next song, Without You, you know, slow it down a little bit. This is a Wetton Howe composition, and Steve's really great guitar work on this. It's so good. Mm. Without You, you know, there's no clunkers on here. It still maybe sounds like a certain time period to some, maybe, but to me, it just sounds like good, tight rock music with some killer keyboards in it. Proggy pop rock.
I wonder if you played these tracks for somebody who maybe, you know, you're talking at the beginning about what kind of reaction do you get when you say Asia, and people mm-hmm. are like, oh, you know, I wonder if you could play them these tracks and they didn't know who it was. oh, hey, this is okay. Really? Because you just told me that you didn't like this.
Right. Yeah. You know,
you got to give it a chance.
And it's not going to appeal to everybody. The hardcore rockers aren't going to like it, you know, and the pop, I don't know. I feel like the pop people would like it.
The pop people would like it if it was cool. That's the problem. And I think you get to a certain point, at least I've gotten to the point in my life where it's like, okay, if you like it, listen to it. If you can, you got to get rid of the prejudices of, oh, this is so-and-so, well, I don't listen to that kind of music, or, oh, you know, if you like it, listen to it. Yeah, just let it kind of play and get rid of whatever prejudices you might have against something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this was a little bit of a no man's land here. You know, was it too proggy for some people and not poppy enough for other people?
Right. And the next song, Cutting It Fine, is a great song. It fits in so well right next to Without You. I don't know. I think it's a great, it's another great song, and it's a little longer. Again, Jeff and Steve helped John Wetton write this. Cutting It Fine, it's not going to be a hit necessarily, but it's a great song. It just fits in so well with the rest of them. And then to me, Here Comes the Feeling is an amazing song, a great way to wrap up the record. And there's a little bit of time changes, and then it kind of ramps up the end. It's a great song to kind of play out on because it goes on a little bit. I think Here Comes the Feeling, another one that Steve Howe wrote with John Wetton. It's fantastic. It's awesome to me.
And it's nice, too, because we've talked about this before. I like when you put, this was originally the last song on the record, that you put one that you want to listen to. It's not like a garbage bin where it's like, oh, we need another one here. Just put this one on. No one's going to listen to it anyway. Yeah, it's a good way to end the record out. And then you get the 10, the Ride Easy, mm-hmm. as a bonus. Like, hey, here's something. Thanks for sticking around.
That's right. You know, and Steve Howe wrote that with John Wetton. And it's one that they eventually performed live when they got back together in the aughts, or the naughties, as they call them over here. it's what they call them on TV and everything. They call them the naughties. When they got back together, they played Ride Easy, you know, because it is such a good song. And it was the B-side. It was the B-side to Heat of the Moment in America. But I think it was the B-side to Only Time Will Tell in the UK.
Okay.
So they swap time again and Ride Easy in the UK and the US as far as B-sides on Heat of the Moment, Only Time Will Tell. Soul Survivor's B-side was Here Comes the Feeling, but a shortened version of it. Like, instead of the one they stretch out and put all the extra, and at the end of Here Comes the Feeling, there's kind of like a, are you just stretching this out just to have more time on the album, you know? I still love it, but it's you know, it's not single, so they have a 3.5 minute version instead of the 5.5 minute version that's so famous. But that record went quadruple platinum in the USA and 10 times platinum around the world. Heat of the Moment was number one for 8 or 9 weeks on mainstream rock, and it was the number one selling album in America in 1982. Unbelievable to me. And the thing is, when they started out on tour, they started out in like theaters, because this is your first album, right? And you don't have any kind of an audience, and they weren't going to play any of their old band stuff. I think Steve got to play clap and you know guitar parts as part of his solo, because like he got a solo and Jeff got a solo and Carl got a solo.
Yeah.
But you know, they only played like 12 or 13, maybe 14 songs, depending on how you count the Steve solos live. So they start off in theaters, but when Heat of the Moment got huge, all of a sudden, there's huge demand for these tickets. So they were selling out 1,500, 2,000 seaters. But later in the tour, they went up to arenas because they were that popular. They were that big on the radio. But those first shows, like, people were scalping the tickets for like 5 times the price because there was that much demand out there for it.
Yeah, and that kind of changes the whole dynamic too of the tour, when you've got to kind of retool it to
mm-hmm.
play in front of an audience that big, you know, with equipment and then, you know, track listings and everything else like that. I can't even imagine. I mean, it's great. That's what you want. You
right.
want to play to more people, but I can't imagine, like, logistically it was like, okay, stop. Let's do this all over again.
Right.
And put together a stadium show.
Yeah, and this was still the era where, like, tickets in the 70s, tickets were cheap. And you basically lost money or didn't make a ton of money on tour. You went out to sell records and you made a bunch of money from the records. Now, of course, it's complete opposite. You lose money making records. People don't really do it as much anymore. Even if they make it in their house or their home studio, you still lose money putting out records, unless maybe you're Taylor Swift or something like that. But all the money is out on tour, which is why artists are having such a hard time right now with COVID. You can't tour and nobody buys records. Everybody's screwed. In the 80s, it was starting to change over a little bit. But Geffen's like, yeah, get them out there and tour and we can sell all these records. And that's what happened. So you wound up 1982, like you started, like, okay, here we are. We're seasoned musicians. We've got a new record, new band. We're at this new label, Geffen. All right, we're going to see how this goes. And by the end of the year, it's huge. It's blown up. You've been all over this new thing called MTV. You start out in theaters, you end in arenas, and maybe even do a couple of stadium gigs or whatever. It's, they got to play not Wembley Stadium, but Wembley Arena, which is right next door. You know, here in England, it's like, man, all right, we're doing great. And you think, okay, now we're just going to go on to our next success. And this might be where we part one. This is where we parse out part one, 1982, and then part two, everything that comes afterwards, because it just wasn't quite the same after it. And it's just, to me, that's the story of Asia. A band that was so close to being something bigger and more special, at least in the kind of American pop culture zeitgeist. And they kind of had a moment in 82, and it was kind of never the same after.
Yeah, and you know, going on to the next record, the Alpha record, I think if they could have flippy-flopped those and maybe kind of started off slower and then put the big one out second, maybe that things would have been different. But to have, like you said, to have that much success right off the bat, it was never going to be the same. Never, ever, never, ever, ever.
Yeah, it's if you're first out, I mean, you know, how well did Hootie and the Blowfish's second album do? Because that first one was a huge hit when we were in college.
Right. Yeah. Again, it's just never the same. They everybody. If, you mean you would figure if you sold, even if you sold 8 records, you want the next one to be 10, 15 on from there. When you sell, when they sell 10 million copies mm-hmm. of the first record, it doesn't matter. You knew that wasn't going to happen. Even if you sold 8.5, that was still going to be a disappointment. It's just, it's the way it goes. And then, you know, oh, well, these guys were, I told you this was just kind of a flash in the pan deal. This was something that wasn't really going to last.
So that's me and Jackson going in-depth on Asia's first album, Asia, released in 1982, the number one selling album in America that year. It always blows people's minds when I tell them that. And you know that that's not all we have to say about Asia. Anyone who knows us knows we're going to go on, and there's a lot more to talk about. So, as you may have guessed, episode 26 is going to be all about Asia beyond the first record, going into Alpha, the next record, the Asia in Asia on MTV concert, and all the albums and lineups, reunions, and so forth that happen over the next almost 40 years. So you can look forward to that. Our stuff is always out on Thursdays. You can check out all past episodes at www.uglyamericanwerewolf.libsyn.com. And make sure you follow us on Twitter at @ugly_werewolf and at @actionjack72. So until next week, be thinking about Asia, dig into that back catalog, and hopefully we'll be hearing from you here real soon on The Wolf. Until then, everybody around the world, be cool and stay safe.
If you rang in the new year with someone special and you're starting a new chapter in your relationship in 2023, Indochino can help you look your best on your big day. With their huge variety of customizable details and fabrics, Indochino lets you design your own unique look, from made-to-measure blazers and suits to a custom portrait-worthy tuxedo, all with no tailor necessary. Shop online to set up your measurement profile and choose your fabric and customizations. Or if you prefer an in-person experience, book an appointment at an Indochino showroom to work with an expert style guide. Then sit back while your suit is made for you and delivered straight to your door. Suits start at just $449 and premium fitted shirts start at $89. So if you're ringing in 2023 with wedding bells, plan your custom look with Indochino. Go to Indochino.com and use code NEWCHAPTER to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's INDOCHINO.com, promo code NEWCHAPTER.
Maryland sports fans, there's only one sports book in the great state of Maryland with over 50 years experience booking bets and supporting customers. Betfred Sportsbook at Longshots is now open and is the only sports book in Frederick offering cash betting on football, basketball, world soccer, and more. Visit the Betfred Sportsbook at I-270 and MD-85 in Frederick, right next to Longshots off-track betting. Go to BetfredSports.com for more information and your chance to win exclusive merchandise. Must be 21 or older. Play responsibly. For help, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football.
FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.